Do you feel a shiver up your spine from fear? Yes, it's another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind. Amp up your imagination and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. The Valley of the Worm by Robert E. Howard. I will tell you of Njord and the Worm. You have heard the tale before many guises, wherein the hero was named Tyr, or Perseus, or Siegfried, or Beowulf, or St. George. But it was Njord who met the loathly demonic thing that crawled hideously up from hell, and from which meeting sprang the cycle of hero tales that revolves down the ages until the very substance of the truth is lost, and passes into the limbo of all forgotten legends. I know whereof I speak, for I was Njord. As I lie here waiting death, which creeps slowly upon me like a blind slug, my dreams are filled with glittering visions and the pageantry of glory. It is not of the drab, disease-racked life of James Allison I dream, but all the gleaming figures of the mighty pageantry that have passed before and shall come after. For I have faintly glimpsed not merely the shapes that trail out behind, but shapes that come after. As a man in a long parade glimpses far ahead the line of figures that precede him, winding over a distant hill, etched shadow-like against the sky. I am one and all the pageantry of shapes and guises and masks which have been, are, and shall be the visible manifestations of that elusive, intangible, but vitally existent spirit now promenading under the brief and temporary name of James Allison. Each man on earth, each woman, is part and all of a similar caravan of shapes and beings. But they cannot remember. Their minds cannot bridge the brief, awful gulfs of blackness which lie between those unstable shapes, and which the spirit, soul, or ego, in spanning, shakes off its fleshy masks. I remember. Why I can remember is the strangest tale of all. But as I lie here with death's black wings slowly unfolding over me, all the dim folds of my previous lives are shaken out before my eyes, and I see myself in many forms and guises, braggart, swaggering, fearful, loving, foolish, all that men have been or will be. I've been man in many lands and many conditions. Vet. And here is another strange thing. My line of reincarnation runs straight down one unerring channel. I've never been any but a man of that restless race men once called Nordheimer, and later Aryans, and today named by many names and designations. The history is my history. From the first mewling wail of a hairless white ape cub in the wastes of the Arctic, to the death cry of the last degenerate product of ultimate civilization in some dim and unguessed future age. My name has been Halmar, Tyr, Bragi, Bran, Horsa, Eric, and John. I strode red-handed through the deserted streets of Rome behind the yellow-maned Brennus. I wandered through the violated plantations with Alaric and his Goths when the flame of burning villas lit the land like day, and an empire was gasping its last out under our sandaled feet. I waded sword in hand through the foaming surf from Hengist Galley to lay the foundations of England in blood and pillage, when Leif the Lucky sighted the broad white beaches of an unguessed world. I stood beside him in the bowels of the dragon ship, my golden beard blowing in the wind, and when Godfrey of Bouillon led his crusaders over the walls of Jerusalem, I was among them, in steel cap and brigandine. But it is of none of these things I would speak. I would take you back with me into an age beside which that of Brennus and Rome is as yesterday. I would take you back through not merely centuries and millenniums, but epochs and dim ages unguessed by the wildest philosopher. Oh, far, far, and far will you fare into the nighted past before you win beyond the boundaries of my race. blue-eyed, yellow-haired, wanderers, slayers, lovers, mighty in rapine and wayfaring. It is the adventure of Niord Wormsbane of which I speak, the root stem of a whole cycle of hero tales which has not yet reached its end, the grisly underlying reality that lurks behind time-distorted myths of dragons, fiends, and monsters. Yet it is not alone with the mouth of Niord that I will speak. I am James Allison, no less than I was Niord, and as I unfold the tale, I will interpret some of his thoughts and dreams and deeds from the mouth of the modern I, so that the saga of Niord shall not be a meaningless chaos to you. His blood is your blood, who are sons of Arion, but wide misty gulfs of eons lie horrifically between, and the deeds and dreams of Niord seem as alien to your deeds and dreams as a primordial and lion-hunted forest seems alien to the white-walled city street. It was a strange world in which Niord lived and loved and fought, so long ago that even my eon-spanning memory cannot recognize landmarks. Since then, the surface of the earth has changed, not once, but a score of times. Continents have risen and sunk. Seas have changed their beds and rivers their courses. Glaciers have waxed and waned, and the very stars and constellations have altered and shifted. It was not so long ago that the cradle land of my race was still in Nordheim, but the epic drifts of my people had already begun, and blue-eyed, yellow-maned tribes flowed eastward and southward and westward on century-long treks that carried them around the world and left their bones and their traces in strange lands and wild waste places. On one of these drifts, I grew from infancy to manhood. My knowledge of that northern homeland was dim memories, like half-remembered dreams, of blinding white snow plains and ice fields, of great fires roaring in the circle of high tents, of yellow manes flying in great winds, and a sun setting in the lurid wallow of crimson clouds, blazing on trampled snow, where still dark forms lay in pools that were redder than the sunset. That last memory stands out clearer than the others. It was the field of Jutunheim, I was told in later years, whereon had just been fought that terrible battle, which was the Armageddon of the Earsfolk, the subject of a cycle of hero songs for long ages, and which still lives today in dim reams of Ragnarok and Gotardimurung. I looked on that battle as a mewling infant, so I must have lived about, but I will not name the age, for I would be called the madman, and historians and geologists alike would rise to refute me. But my memories of Nordheim were few and dim, paled by memories of that long, long trek upon which I spent my life. We had not kept to a straight course, but our trend had been forever southward. Sometimes we had abided for a while in fertile upland valleys or rich river-traversed plains, but always we took up the trail again, and not always because of drought or famine. Often we left countries teeming with game and wild grain to push into wastelands. On our trail, we moved endlessly, driven only by our restless whim, yet blindly following a cosmic law, the workings of which we never guessed, any more than the wild geese guess in their flights around the world. So at last we came into the country of the worm. I will take up the tale at the time when we came into jungle-clad hills, reeking with rot and teeming with spawning life, where the tom-toms of a savage people pulse incessantly through the hot, breathless night. These people came forth to dispute our way, short, strongly built men, black-haired, painted, ferocious, but indisputably fierce. We knew their breed of old. They were Picts, and all of alien races the fiercest. We had met their kind before in thick forests, and in upland valleys beside mountain lakes, but many moons had passed since those meetings. I believe this particular tribe represented the easternmost rift of the race. They were the most primitive and ferocious of any I ever met. Already they were exhibiting hints of characteristics I have noted among savages in jungle countries, though they had dwelt in these environs only a few generations. The abysmal jungle was engulfing them, was obliterating their pristine characteristics and shaping them in its own horrific mold. They were drifting into headhunting, and cannibalism was but a step which I believe they must have taken before they became extinct. These things are natural adjuncts to the jungle. The pigs did not learn them from the people that were there before, for then there were none among those hills. In later years, they came up from the south, and the pigs first enslaved and then absorbed them. But with that, my Sag of Njord is not concerned. We came into that brutish hill country with its squalling abysms of savagery and primitiveness. We were a whole tribe, marching on foot, old men, wolfish with their long beards and gaunt limbs, giant warriors in their prime, naked children running along the line of march, women with tousled yellow locks carrying babies, which never cried, unless it were to scream from pure rage. I do not remember our numbers, except that there were some 500 fighting men, and by fighting men I mean all males, from the child just strong enough to lift a bow, to the oldest of the old men. In that madly ferocious age, all were fighters. Our women fought when brought to bay like tigresses, and I've seen a babe not yet old enough to stammer articulate words twist its head and sink its tiny teeth in the foot that stamped out its life. Oh, we were fighters. Let me speak of Njord. I'm proud of him, the more when I consider the paltry crippled body of James Allison, the unstable mask I now wear. Njord was tall, with great shoulders, lean hips, and mighty limbs. His muscles were long and swelling, denoting endurance and speed as well as strength. He could run all day without tiring, and he possessed a coordination that made his movements a blur of blinding speed. If I told you his full strength, he would brand me a liar. But there is no man on earth today strong enough to bend the bow Njord handled with ease. The longest arrow flight on record is that of a Turkish archer who sent a shaft 482 yards. There was not a stripling in my tribe who could not have bettered that flight. As we entered the jungle country, we heard the tom-toms booming across the mysterious valleys that slumbered between the brutish hills, and in a broad, open plateau we met our enemies. I do not believe these pigs knew us, even by legends, or they had never rushed so openly to the onset, though they outnumbered us. But there was no attempt at ambush. They swarmed out of the trees, dancing and singing their war songs, yelling their barbarous threats. Our heads should hang in their idol hut, and our yellow-haired women should bear their sons. Ho, ho, ho. By Ymir, it was Njord who laughed then, not James Allison. Just so we are the Aesir laughed to hear their threats. Deep thunderous laughter from broad and mighty chests. Our trail was laid in blood and embers through many lands. We were the slayers and ravishers, striding sword in hand across the world, and that these folk threatened us woke our rugged humor. We went to meet them, naked but for our wolf hides, swinging our bronze swords, and our singing was like rolling thunder in the hills. They sent their arrows among us, and we gave back their fire. They could not match us in archery. Our arrows hissed in blinding clouds among them, dropping them like autumn leaves, until they howled and frothed like mad dogs and charged to hand grips. And we, mad with the fighting joy, dropped our bows and ran to meet them, as a lover runs to his love. By Ymir, it was a battle to madden and make drunk with slaughter and the fury. The Picts were as ferocious as we, but ours was the superior physique, the keener wit, the more highly developed fighting brain. We won because we were a superior race, but it was no easy victory. Corpses littered the blood-soaked earth, but at last they broke, and we cut them down as they ran, to the very edge of the trees. I tell of that fight in a few bald words. I cannot paint the madness, the reek of sweat and blood, the panting, muscle-straining effort, the splintering of bones under mighty blows, the rending and hewing of quivering sentient flesh, above all the merciless, abysmal savagery of the whole affair, in which there was neither rule nor order, each man fighting as he would or could. If I might do so, you would recoil in horror. Even the modern eye, cognizant of my close friendship with those times, stand aghast as I review that butchery. Mercy was not yet unborn, save as some individual's whim, and rules of warfare were as yet undreamed of. It was an age in which each tribe and each human fought tooth and fang from birth to death, and neither gave nor expected mercy. So we cut down the fleeing Picts, and our women came out on the field to brain the wounded enemies with stones or cut their throats with copper knives. We did not torture. We were no more cruel than life demanded. The rule of life was ruthlessness. But there's more wanton cruelty today than ever we dreamed of. It was not wanton bloodthirstiness that made us butcher wounded and captive foes. It was because we knew our chances of survival increase with each enemy slain. Yet there was occasionally a touch of individual mercy, and so it was in this fight. I'd been occupied with a duel with an especially valiant enemy. His tousled thatch of black hair scarcely came above my chin, but he was a solid knot of steel spring muscles, then which lightning scarcely moved faster. He had an iron sword and a hide-covered buckler. I had a knotty-headed bludgeon. That fight was one that glutted even my battle-lusting soul. I was bleeding from a score of flesh wounds before one of my terrible slashing strokes smashed his shield like cardboard, and an instant later my bludgeon glanced from his unprotected head. Emir, even now I stop to laugh and marvel at the hardness of that pig skull. Men of that age were assuredly built on a rugged plan. That blow should have spattered his brains like water. It did lay his scalp open, horribly, dashing him senseless to the earth, where I let him lie, supposing him to be dead, as I joined in the slaughter of the fleeing warriors. When I returned, reeking with sweat and blood, my club horridly clotted with blood and brains, I noticed that my antagonist was regaining consciousness, and that a naked, tousle-headed girl was preparing to give him the finishing touch with a stone she could scarcely lift. A vagrant whim caused me to check the blow. I had enjoyed the fight, and I admired the adamantine quality of his skull. We made camp a short distance away, burned our dead on a great pyre, and after looting the corpses of the enemy, we dragged them across a plateau and cast them down in a valley to make a feast for the hyenas, jackals, and vultures which were already gathering. We kept close watch that night, but we were not attacked, though far away through the jungle we could make out the red gleam of fires and could faintly hear, when the wind veered, the throbs of tom-toms and demonic screams and yells, keenings for the slain, or mere animal squallings of fury. Nor did they attack us in the days that followed. We bandaged our captive's wounds and quickly learned its primitive language, which, however, was so different from ours that I cannot conceive of the two languages having ever had a common source. His name was Grom, and he was a great hunter and fighter, he boasted. He talked freely and held no grudge, greeting broadly and showing tusk-like teeth, his beady eyes glittering from under the tangled black mane that fell over his low forehead. His limbs were almost ape-like in their thickness. He was vastly interested in his captors, though he could never understand why he had been spared. To the end, it remained an inexplicable mystery to him. The pigs obeyed the law of survival even more rigidly than did the Aesir. They were the more practical, as shown by their more settled habits. They never roamed as far or as blindly as we. Yet in every line, we were the superior race. Grom, impressed by our intelligence and fighting qualities, volunteered to go into the hills and make peace for us with his people. It was immaterial to us, but we let him go. Slavery had not yet been dreamed of. So Grom went back to his people, and we forgot about him, except that I went a trifle more cautiously about my hunting, expecting him to be lying in wait to put an arrow through my back. Then one day we heard a rattle of tom-toms, and Grom appeared at the edge of the jungle. His face split in his gorilla grin, with a painted, skin-clad, feather-bedecked chief of the clans. Our ferocity had awed them, and our sparing of Grom further impressed them. They could not understand leniency. Evidently, we valued them too cheaply to bother about killing one when he was in our power. So peace was made with much powwow, and sworn to with many strange oaths and rituals. We swore only by Emir, and Aesir never broke that vow. But they swore by the elements, by the idol which sat in the fetish hut, where fires burned forever, and a withered crone slapped a leather-covered drum all night long, and by another being too terrible to be named. Then we all sat around the fires and gnawed meat bones, and drank a fiery concoction they brewed from wild grain. And the wonder is that the feast did not end in a general massacre, for that liquor had devils in it and made maggots writhe in our brains. But no harm came of our vast drunkenness, and thereafter we dwelt at peace with our barbarous neighbors. They taught us many things and learned many more from us, but they taught us iron workings, into which they had been forced by the lack of copper in those hills, and we quickly excelled them. We went freely among their villages, mud-walled clusters of huts and hilltop clearings, overshadowed by giant trees, and we allowed them to come out well among our camps, straggling lines of hide tents on the plateau where the battle had been fought. Our young men cared not for their squat, beady-eyed women, and our rangy, clean-limbed girls with their tousled yellow heads were not drawn to the hairy-breasted savages. Familiarity over a period of years would have reduced the repulsion on either side, until the two races would have flowed together to form one hybrid people. But long before that time, the Aesir rose and departed, vanishing into the mysterious hazes of the haunted south. But before the exodus there came to pass the horror of the worm. I hunted with Grom, and he led me into brooding uninhabited valleys, and up into silence-haunted hills, where no man had set foot before us. But there was one valley, off in the mazes of the southwest, into which he would not go. Stumps of shattered columns, relics of a forgotten civilization, stood among the trees on the valley floor. Grom showed them to me, as we stood on the cliffs that flanked the mysterious vale, but he would not go down into it, and he dissuaded me when I would have gone alone. He would not speak plainly of the danger that lurked there, but it was greater than that of serpent or tiger, or the trumpeting elephants which occasionally wandered up in devastating droves from the south. Of all beasts, Grom told me in the gutturals of his long tongue, the Picts feared only Satha, the great snake, and they shunned the jungle where he lived. But there was another thing they feared, and it was connected in some manner with a valley of broken stones, as the Picts called the crumbling pillars. Long ago, when his ancestors had first come into the country, they had dared that grim vale, and a whole clan of them had perished, suddenly, horribly, and unexplainably. At least Grom did not explain. The horror had come up out of the earth, somehow, and it was not good to talk of it, since it was believed that it might be summoned by speaking of it, whatever it was. But Grom was ready to hunt with me anywhere else, for he was the greatest hunter among the Picts, and many and fearful were our adventures. Once I killed with the iron sword I had forged with my own hands the most terrible of all beasts, old Sabretooth, which men today call a tiger because he was more like a tiger than anything else. In reality, he was almost as much like a bear in build, save for his unmistakably feline head. Sabretooth was massive-limbed, with a low-hung, great heavy body, and he vanished from the earth because he was too terrible a fighter, even for that grim age. As his muscles in ferocity grew, his brain dwindled until at last even the instinct of self-preservation vanished. Nature, who maintains her balance in such things, destroyed him, because, had his super-fighting powers been allied with an intelligent brain, he would have destroyed all other forms of life on earth. He was a freak on the road of evolution, organic development gone mad, and run to fangs and talons to slaughter and destruction. I killed Sabretooth in a battle that would make a Sagan itself, and for months afterwards I lay semi-delirious with ghastly wounds that made the toughest warriors shake their head. The Picts said that never before had a man killed a Sabretooth single-handed, yet I recovered to the wonder of all. While I lay at the doors of death, there was a secession from the tribe. It was a peaceful secession, such as continually occurred and contributed greatly to the peopling of the world by yellow-haired tribes. 45 of the young men took themselves mates simultaneously and wandered off to found a clan of their own. There was no revolt. It was a racial custom, which bore fruits in all the later ages, when tribes sprung from the same roots met after centuries of separation and cut one another's throats with joyous abandon. The tendency of the Aryan and the pre-Aryan was always towards disunity, clans splitting off the main stem and scattering. So these young men, led by one Bragi, my brother-in-arms, took their girls and, venturing to the southwest, took up their abode in the Valley of Broken Stones. The Picts expostulated, hinting vaguely of a monstrous doom that haunted the vale. But the Aesir laughed. We had left our own demons and weirds in the icy wastes of the far blue north, and the devils of other races did not much impress us. When my full strength was returned, and the grisly wound were only scars, I girt on my weapons and strode over the plateau to visit Bragi's clan. Grom did not accompany me. He had not been in the Aesir camp for several days. But I knew the way. I remembered well the valley from the cliffs, of which I had looked down and seen the lake at the upper end, the trees thickening into forest at the lower extremity. The sides of the valley were high sheer cliffs, and a steep broad ridge at either end cut it off from the surrounding country. It was toward the lower or southwestern end that the valley floor was dotted thickly with ruined columns, some towering high among the trees, some fallen into heaps of lichen-clad stones. What race reared them none knew, but Grom had hinted fearsomely of a hairy, apish monstrosity, dancing loathsomely under the moon to a demonic piping that induced horror and madness. Across a plateau, whereupon our camp was pitched, descended the slope, traversed a shallow, vegetation-choked valley, climbed another slope, and plunged into the hills. A half-day's leisurely travel brought me to the ridge on the other side of which lay the Valley of the Pillars. For many miles, I had seen no sign of human life. The settlements of the Picts all lay many miles to the east. I topped the ridge and looked down into the dreaming valley with its still blue lake, its brooding cliffs and its broken columns jutting among the trees. I looked for smoke. I saw none, but I saw vultures wheeling in the sky over a cluster of tents on the lake shore. I came down the ridge warily and approached the silent camp. In it I halted, frozen with horror. I was not easily moved. I had seen death in many forms and had fled from or taken part in red massacres that spilled blood like water and heaped the earth with corpses. But here I was confronted with an organic devastation that staggered and appalled me. Of Bragi's embryonic clan, not one remained alive, and not one corpse was whole. Some of the high tents still stood erect. Others were smashed down and flattened out, as if crushed by some monstrous weight, so that at first I wondered if a drove of elephants had stampeded across the camp. But no elephants ever wrought such destruction as I saw strewn on the bloody ground. The camp was a shambles, littered with bits of flesh and fragments of bodies, hands, feet, heads, pieces of human debris. Weapons lay about, some of them stained with a greenish slime, like that which spurts from a crushed caterpillar. No human folk could have committed this ghastly atrocity. I looked at the lake, wondering if nameless amphibian monsters had crawled from the calm waters whose deep blue told of unfathomed depths. Then I saw a print left by the destroyer. It was a track such as a titanic worm might leave, yards broad, winding back down the valley. The grass lay flat where it ran, and bushes and small trees had been crushed down into the earth, all horribly smeared with blood and greenish slime. With berserk fury in my soul, I drew my sword and started to follow it, when a call attracted me. I wheeled to see a stocky form approaching me from the ridge. It was Gorm the Pick, and when I think of the courage it must have taken for him to have overcome all the instincts planted in him by traditional teachings and personal experience, I realize the full depths of his friendship for me. Squatting on the lake shore, spear in his hands, his black eyes ever roving fearfully down the brooding, tree-waving reaches of the valley, Grom told me of the horror that had come upon Bragi's clan under the moon. But first he told me of it, as Osiris had told the tale to him. Long ago the Picts had drifted down from the northwest on a long, long trek, finally reaching these jungle-covered hills, where because they were weary and because the game and fruit were plentiful, and there were no hostile tribes, they halted and built their mud-walled villages. Some of them, a whole clan of that numerous tribe, took up their abode in the Valley of the Broken Stones. They found the columns in a great ruined temple back in the trees, and in that temple there was no shrine or altar, but the mouth of a shaft that vanished deep into the black earth, and in which there were no steps such as a human being would make and use. They built their village in the valley, and in the night, under the moon, horror came upon them, and left only broken walls and bits of slime-smeared flesh. In those days the Picts feared nothing. The warriors of the other clans gathered and sang their war songs and danced their war dances, and followed a broad track of blood and slime to the shaft mouth in the temple. They howled defiance and hurled down boulders, which were never heard to strike bottom. Then began a thin, demonic piping, and up from the wall pranced a hideous anthropomorphic figure, dancing to the weird strains of a pipe it held in its monstrous hands. The horror of its aspect froze the fierce Picts with amazement, and close behind it a vast white bulk heaved up from the subterranean darkness. Out of the shaft came a slavering mad nightmare, which arrows pierced but could not check, which swords carved but could not slay, It fell slobbering upon the warriors, crushing them to crimson pulp, tearing them to bits as an octopus might tear small fishes, sucking their blood from their mangled limbs and devouring them even as they screamed and struggled. The survivors fled, pursued to the very ridge, up which apparently the monster could not propel its quaking mountainous bulk. After that, they did not dare the silent valley, but the dead came to the shaman and old men in dreams and told them strange and terrible secrets. They spoke of an ancient race of semi-human beings which once inhabited that valley and reared those columns for their own weird, inexplicable purposes. The white monster in the pits was their god, summoned up from the nighted abysses of mid-earth, uncounted fathoms below the black mold, by sorcery unknown to the sons of men. The hairy, anthropomorphic being was its servant, created to serve the god, a formless, elemental spirit drawn up from below, encased in flesh, organic but beyond the understanding of humanity. The old ones had long vanished into the limbo from whence they crawled in the black dawn of the universe. But their bestial god and his inhuman slave lived on. Yet both were organic after a fashion, and could be wounded, though no human weapon had been found potent enough to slay them. Bragi and his clan had dwelt for weeks in the valley before the horror struck. Only the night before, Grom, hunting above the cliffs, and by that token daring greatly, had been paralyzed by high-pitched demon piping, and then by a mad clamor of human screaming. Stretched face down in the dirt, hiding his head in a tangle of grass, he had not dared to move, even when the shrieks died away, in the slobbering, repulsive sounds of a hideous feast. When dawn broke, he had crept shuddering to the cliffs to look down into the valley, and the sight of the devastation, even when seen from afar, had driven him in yammering flight far into the hills. But it had occurred to him finally that he should warn the rest of the tribe, and returning on his way to the camp on the plateau, he had seen me entering the valley. So spoke Grom, while I sat and brooded darkly, my chin on my mighty fist. I cannot frame in modern words the clan feeling that in those days was a living vital part of every man and woman, in a world where talon and fang were lifted on every hand, and the hands of all men raised against an individual, except those of his own clan. Tribal instinct was more than the phrase it is today, is as much a part of a man as was his heart or his right hand. This was necessary, for thus only banded together in unbreakable groups could mankind have survived in the terrible environment of the primitive world. So now the personal grief I felt for Bagi and the clean-limbed young men and laughing white-skinned girls was drowned in a deeper sea of grief and fury that was cosmic in its depth and intensity. I sat grimly, while the pig squatted anxiously beside me, his gaze roving from me to the menacing deeps of the valley, where the accursed columns loomed like broken teeth of cackling hags among the waving leafy reaches. I, Njord, was not one to use my brain overmuch. I lived in a physical world, and there were the old men of the tribe to do my thinking. But I was one of a race destined to become dominant mentally as well as physically, and I was no mere muscular animal. So I sat there. There came, dimly and then clearly, a thought to me that brought a short, fierce laugh from my lips. Rising, I bade Grom aid me, and we built a pyre on the lakeshore of dried wood, the ridge poles of the tents and the broken shafts of spears. Then we collected the grisly fragments that had been parts of Bragi's band, and we laid them on the pile and struck flint and steel to it. The thick, sad smoke crawled serpent-like into the sky, and turning to Grom, I made him guide me to the jungle where lurked that scaly horror, Satha, the great serpent. Grom gaped at me. Not the greatest hunters among the pits sought out the mighty crawling one, but my will was like a wind that swept him along my course, and at last he led the way. We left the valley by the upper end, crossing the ridge, skirting the tall cliffs, and plunged into the fastness of the south, which was peopled only by the grim denizens of the jungle. Deep into the jungle we went, until we came to a low-lying expanse, dank and dark, beneath the creeper-festooned trees, where our feet sank deep into the spongy silt, carpeted by rotting vegetation and slimy moisture oozed up beneath their pressure. This, Grom told me, was the realm haunted by Satha, the great serpent. Let me speak of Satha. There's nothing like him on Earth today, nor has there been for countless ages. Like the meat-eating dinosaur, like old Sabretooth, he was too terrible to exist. Even then, he was a survival of a grimmer age when life and its forms were cruder and more hideous. There were not many of his kind then, though they may have existed in great numbers in the reeking ooze of the vast jungle-tangled swamps still further south. It was larger than any python of modern ages, and his fangs dripped with poison 1,000 times more deadly than that of a king cobra. He was never worshipped by the pure-blood Picts, though the others that came later deified him, and that adoration persisted in the hybrid races that sprang from different conquerors. But to other people, he was the nadir of evil horror, and tales of him became twisted into demonology. So in later ages, Satha became the veritable devil of the white races, and the Stygians first worshipped. And then, when they became Egyptians, abhorred him under the name of Set, the old serpent, while to the Semites he became Leviathan and Satan. He was terrible enough to be a god, for he was a crawling death. I had seen a bull elephant fall dead in his tracks from Satha's bite. I had seen him, had glimpsed him writhing his horrific way through the dense jungle, had seen him take his prey, but I had never hunted him. He was too grim, even for the slayer of old Sabretooth. But now I hunted him, plunging further and further into the hot, breathless reek of his jungle. Even when friendship for me could not drive Grom further, he urged me to paint my body and sing my death song before I advanced further, but I pushed on unheeding. In a natural runway that wound between the shouldering trees, I set a trap. I found a large tree, soft and spongy of fiber, but thick, bold, and heavy, and I hacked through its base close to the ground with my great sword, directing its fall so that when it toppled, its top crashed into the branches of a smaller tree, leaving it leaning across the runway, one end resting on the earth, the other caught in a small tree. Then I cut away the branches on the underside, and cutting a slim, tough sapling, I trimmed it and stuck it upright like a prop pole under the leaning tree. Then cutting away the tree which supported it, I left a great trunk poised precariously on the prop pole, to which I fastened a long vine as thick as my wrist. Then I went alone through that primordial twilight jungle until an overpowering fetid odor assailed my nostrils, and from the rank vegetation in front of me Satha reared up, his hideous head swaying lethally from side to side, while his forked tongue jetted in and out, and his great yellow terrible eyes burned icily on me with all the evil wisdom of the black elder world that was when man was not. I backed away, feeling no fear, only an icy sensation along my spine, and Satha came sinuously after me, his shining 80-foot barrel rippling over the rotting vegetation in mesmeric silence. His wedge-shaped head was bigger than the head of the hugest stallion, his trunk was thicker than a man's body, and his scales shimmered with 1,000 changing scintillations. I was to Satha as a mouse is to a king cobra, but I was fanged as no mouse ever was. Quick as I was, I knew I could not avoid the lightning stroke of that great triangular head, so I dared not let him come too close. Subtly, I fled down the runway, and behind me the rush of the great supple body was like the sweep of wind through the grass. He was not far behind me when I raced beneath the dreadfall, and as the great shining length glided under the trap, I gripped the vine with both hands and jerked desperately. With a crash, the great trunk fell across Scatha's scaly back, some 6 feet back of his wedge-shaped head. I had hoped to break his spine, but I do not think it did, for the great body coiled and knotted, the mighty tail lashed and thrashed, mowing down the bushes as if with a giant flail. At the instant of the fall, the huge head had whipped about and struck the tree with a terrific impact, the mighty fangs shearing through bark and wood like scimitars. Now, as if aware he fought an inanimate foe, Satha turned on me, standing out of his reach. The scaly neck writhed and arched, the mighty jaws gaped, disclosing fangs a foot in length, from which dripped venom that might have burned through solid stone. I believed, what of his stupendous strength, that Satha would have writhed from under the trunk, but for a broken branch that had been driven deep into his hide, holding him like a barb. The sound of his hissing filled the jungle, and his eyes glared at me with such concentrated evil that I shook despite myself. Oh, he knew it was I who had trapped him. Now I came as close as I dared, and with a sudden powerful cast of my spear, transfixed his neck just below the gaping jaws, nailing him to the tree trunk. Then I dared greatly, for he was far from dead, and I knew he would be in an instant tear the spear from the wood and be free to strike. But in that instant I ran in, and swinging my sword with all my great power, I hewed off his terrible head. The heavings and contortions of Satha's prison form in life were not to the convulsions of his headless length in death. I retreated, dragging the gigantic head after me, with a crooked pole, and at a safe distance from the lashing, flailing tail, I set to work. I worked with naked death then, and no man ever toiled more gingerly than did I, for I cut out the poison sacs at the base of the great fangs, and in that terrible venom I soaked the heads of 11 arrows, being careful that only the bronze points were in the liquid, which else had corroded away the wood of the tough shafts. While I was doing this, Grom, driven by comradeship and curiosity, came stealing nervously through the jungle, and his mouth gaped as he looked on the head of Satha. For hours I steeped the arrowheads in the poison, until they were caked with a horrible green scum, and showed tiny flecks of corrosion, where the venom had eaten into the solid bronze. He wrapped them carefully in broad, thick, rubber-like leaves, and then, though night had fallen, and the hunting beasts were roaring on every hand, I went back through the jungled hills, Grom with me, until at dawn we came again to the high cliffs that loomed above the Valley of Broken Stones. At the mouth of the valley, I broke my spear, and I took all the unpoisoned shafts from my quiver and snapped them. I painted my face and limbs, as the Azir painted themselves only when they went forth to certain doom, and I sang my death song to the sun as it rose over the cliffs, my yellow mane blowing in the morning wind. Then I went down into the valley, bow in hand. Grom could not drive himself to follow me. He lay on his belly in the dust and howled like a dying dog. I passed the lake and the silent camp where the pyre ashes still smoldered, and came under the thickening trees beyond. About me the columns loomed, mere shapeless heaps from the ravages of staggering eons. The trees grew more dense, and under their vast leafy branches the very light was dusky and evil. As in twilight shadow, I saw the ruined temple, cyclopean walls staggering up from masses of decaying masonry and fallen blocks of stone. About 600 yards in front of it, a great column reared up in an open glade, 80 or 90 feet in height. It was so worn and pitted by weather and time that any child of my tribe could have climbed it, and I marked it and changed my plan. I came to the ruins and saw huge crumbling walls upholding a domed roof from which many stones had fallen, so that it seemed like the lichen-grown ribs of some mythical monster skeleton arching above me. Titanic columns flanked the open doorway through which 10 elephants could have walked abreast. Once there might have been inscriptions and hieroglyphics on the pillars and walls, but they were long worn away. Around the great room, on the inner side ran columns in better state of preservation. On each of these columns was a flat pedestal, and some dim, distinctive memory vaguely resurrected a shadowy scene wherein black drums roared madly, and on these pedestals monstrous beings squatted loathsomely in inexplicable rituals rooted in the black dawn of the universe. There was no altar, only the mouth of a great well-like shaft in the stone floor with strange obscene carvings all about the rim. I tore great pieces of stone from the rotting floor and cast them down the shaft, which slanted down into utter darkness. I heard them bound along the side, but I did not hear them strike bottom. I cast down stone after stone, each with a searing curse, and at last I heard a sound that was not the dwindling rumble of the falling stones. Out from the well floated a weird demon piping that was a symphony of madness. Far down in the darkness I glimpsed the faint, fearful glimmering of a vast white bulk. I retreated slowly as the piping grew louder, falling back through the broad doorway. I heard a scratching, scrambling noise, and up from the shaft and out of the doorway between the colossal columns came a prancing, incredible figure. It went erect like a man, but it was covered with fur that was shaggiest where its face should have been. If it had ears, nose, and a mouth, I did not discover them. Only a pair of staring red eyes leered from the furry mask. Its misshapen hands held a strange set of pipes, on which it blew weirdly as it pranced towards me with many a grotesque caper and leap. Behind it I heard a repulsive, obscene noise as of a quaking, unstable mass heaving up out of a well. Then I knocked an arrow, drew the cord, and sent a shaft singing through the furry breast of the dancing monstrosity. It went down as though struck by a thunderbolt, but to my horror the piping continued, though the pipes had fallen from the malformed hands. Then I turned and ran fleetly to the column up which I swarmed before I looked back. When I reached the pinnacle, I looked, and because of the shock and surprise of what I saw, I almost fell from my dizzy perch. Out of the temple, the monstrous dweller in the darkness had come, and I, who had expected a horror yet cast in some terrestrial mold, looked on the spawn of nightmare. From what subterranean hell it crawled in the long ago, I know not, nor what black age it represented, but it was not a beast, as humanity knows beast. I call it a worm, for lack of a better term. There is no earthly language which has a name for it. I can only say that it looked somewhat more like a worm than it did an octopus, a serpent, or a dinosaur. It was white and pulpy, and drew its quaking bulk along the ground, worm-like fashion. But it had white flat tentacles and fleshy feelers, and other adjuncts, the use of which I am unable to explain. And it had a long proboscis, which it curled and uncurled like an elephant's trunk. Its 40 eyes set in a horrific circle were composed of thousands of facets, as of many scintillant colors, were changed in alter and never-ending transmutation. But through all interplay of hue and glint, they retained their evil intelligence. Intelligence there was behind those flickering facets, not human nor yet bestial, but a night-born demonic intelligence such as men in dreams vaguely sense throbbing titanically in the black gulfs outside our material universe. In size the monster was mountainous, its bulk would have dwarfed a mastodon. But even as I shook with the cosmic horror of the thing, I drew a feathered shaft to my ear and arched it singing on its way. Grass and bushes were crushed flat as the monster came toward me like a moving mountain, and shaft after shaft I sent with terrific force and deadly precision. I could not miss so huge a target. The arrow sank to the feathers or clear out of sight in the unstable bulk, each bearing enough poison to have stricken dead a bull elephant. Yet on it came, swiftly, appallingly, apparently heedless of both the shafts and the venom in which they were steeped, and all the time the hideous music played with a maddening accompaniment, whining thinly from the pipes that lay untouched in the ground. My confidence faded. Even the poison of Sappho was futile against this uncanny being. I drove my last staff almost straight downward into the quaking white mountain, so close was the monster under my perch. Then suddenly its color altered. A wave of ghastly blue surged over it, and the vast hulk heaved in earthquake-like convulsions. With a terrible plunge, it struck the lower part of the column, which crashed to falling shards of stone. But even with the impact, I leaped far out and fell through the empty air full upon the monster's back. The spongy skin yielded and gave beneath my feet, and I drove my sword hilt deep, dragging it through the pulpy flesh, ripping a horrible yard-long room from which oozed green slime. Then a flip of a cable-like tentacle flicked me from the titan's back and spun me 300 feet through the air to crash among a cluster of giant trees. The impact must have splintered half the bones in my frame, for when I sought to grasp my sword again and crawl anew to the combat, I could not move hand or foot, could only writhe helplessly with my broken back. But I could see the monster, and I knew that I had won, even in defeat. The mountainous bulk was heaving and billowing. The tentacles were lashing madly. The antennae writhing and nodding, and the nauseous whiteness had changed to a pale and grisly green. It turned ponderously and lurched back toward the temple, rolling like a crippled ship in a heavy swell. Trees crashed and splintered as it lumbered against them. I wept with pure fury because I could not catch up my sword and rush in to die glutting my berserk madness in mighty strokes. But the worm god was death-stricken and needed not my futile sword. The demon pipes on the ground kept up their infernal tune, and it was the fiend's death dirge. Then, as the monster veered and floundered, I saw it catch up the corpse of its hairy slave. For an instant, the apish form dangled in midair, gripped round by the trunk-like prosobix, then was dashed against the temple wall with a force that reduced the hairy body to mere shapeless pulp. At last the pipes screamed out horribly and fell silent forever. The Titan staggered on the brink of the shaft. Then another change came over it, a frightful transfiguration, the nature of which I can not yet describe. Even now, when I try to think of it clearly, I am only chaotically conscious of a blasphemous, unnatural transmutation of form and substance, shocking and indescribable. Then the strangely altered bulk tumbled into the shaft to roll down into the ultimate darkness from whence it came, and I knew that it was dead. And as it vanished into the well, with a rending, grinding groan, the ruined walls quivered from dome to base. They bent inward and buckled with deafening reverberation. The column splintered, and with a cataclysmic crash, the dome itself came thundering down. For an instant, the air seemed veiled with flying debris and stone dust, through which the treetops lashed madly, as in a storm or an earthquake convulsion. Then all was clear again, and I stared, shaking the blood from my eyes. Where the temple had stood, there lay only a colossal pile of shattered masonry and broken stones, and every column in the valley had fallen to lie in crumbling shards. In the silence that followed, I heard Grom wailing a dirge over me. I bade him lay my sword in my hand, and he did so, and bent close to hear what I had to say, for I was passing swiftly. "Let my tribe remember," I said, speaking slowly. "Let the tale be told from village to village, from camp to camp, from tribe to tribe, so that men may know that not man nor beast nor devil may prey in safety on the golden-haired people of Asgard. Let them build me a cairn where I lie and lay me therein with my bow and sword at hand to guard this valley forever. So if the ghost of the god I slew comes up from below, my ghost will ever be ready to give it battle." And while Grom howled and beat his hairy chest, death came to me in the valley of the worm.